This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm here in our Lexington, Kentucky studio. Thank you to everyone joining me tonight throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM 206. And don't forget, you can listen to our live streaming as well as replays of previous shows at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to benefit the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. You can show your support as well by going to pdjf.org. I'm here tonight with a rider who just recently hit the 2,000 career win milestone. Wow, what an accomplishment. And actually, he has 2,065 wins, to be exact, as well as over $60 million in earnings. He's been tearing it up at Woodbine. I am very happy to introduce to you jockey Jesse Campbell. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. And I just heard that you're currently on the shelf with an injury, and you're spending some time in Chicago. Let's start out with telling us how you're doing.
I'm doing good. It was November 5th when the spill happened. So it's been a good, close to 6 weeks or so. But shoulder's doing good, the hand's doing good, and I'm finally starting to feel back to normal, and can't wait to get back in the saddle again.
Oh, I'm sure. I know that feeling. And so you're in Chicago. Is that where you frequently spend your winters?
No. I've been going to New Orleans, the fairgrounds, since like 99 was the first year that I went there. Last year I didn't go. I had some work done on my knees, both my knees. And then this year, you know, I had that little spill in November there, quite frankly, I didn't even plan on going to New Orleans because the way that the meets intersect now, the fairground starts earlier than it usually had in the past.
Sure.
So I would get there about a month late, and I would have to leave early to go back to Woodbine, and it just really didn't fit in the plans anymore. So I plan on taking every winter off now for as long as I continue to ride.
Sure, and take some well-deserved time off and recuperate. And Jesse, we typically start these shows off with the very beginning, how you got started in the sport. And you were born in Twinsburg, Ohio, if I read correctly. And is that where you grew up?
I have a twin, my brother Joel. We left Ohio, I think, when we were 2 or 3 years old. My dad was training in Ohio at the time, which, by the way, I should start out, I'm fourth generation. My dad did ride races. He was hurt very badly in a spill at Oakland. He was in a hospital for over a year. I mean, he literally broke the whole entire left side of his body. He was in traction for, I think, close to 6 months, so he really got banged up bad.
Wow.
And then when he recovered, he went on to training horses, which he always said that he wanted to do. He said he only wanted to ride a short time. So Dad was in Ohio training, and he was leading trainer, I think, for 2 or 3 years in a row. And then he made the move to Chicago. And then we grew up in Chicago, Lake Zurich, ever since. Went to grade school, junior high school, graduated high school. And I think the day after I graduated high school, I started riding races.
Wow. So how was it having your dad ride races and to have that very terrible injury? Did that ever affect your thinking when you decided you wanted to become a rider?
You know, when I started, I think when you're young and, you know, the old saying, you're young and dumb, I never thought about it. I will say my parents and my family never wanted me or my brother to ride races. We started riding horses. I mean, you know, I think they said we were riding since we were like two or whatever, but they kept us away from it for a long time. We grew up riding show horses, jumping horses, eventing horses. And they really tried to keep us away from it. In fact, when I was a kid growing up, I really don't remember going to track that much. And I think it was somewhere around 15, I just, for whatever reason, you know, I don't even remember to this day, like, what made me get that bug for the racing. And I literally just dropped show horses and just 100% just all in about racehorses. I mean, I remember I would go to the track before I could get my license at 16 to, you know, to be on the racetrack. I would go in the mornings. Even during high school, I would gallop horses before I would go to school. I had it set up where I didn't have to be, I never took study hall or anything like that. I took the maximum credit my freshman, sophomore year. So junior year and senior year, I could do what was called a work program at that time. So I didn't have to be at school till like 11:30. So I would get up and get on horses and get to a track before I would go to school. Which, you know, it was tough. I was paying attention to school as much as I could.
So horses were always your primary focus. There was never any thought of going on and doing anything else.
No. I mean, I never even considered college. My brother, he went to 3 years of college right out of high school before he started riding. And I honestly, I think that I was doing really, really, like the first 2 years of the road, I mean, I was just, I couldn't do anything wrong. I mean, we were just winning races hand over fist. And I think my brother, you know, saw that. And then he came to our family and said that he wanted to start riding races. And I really didn't want him to do it. This is just my opinion. It's great when it's great, and it's bad when it's bad. And you know, sometimes you don't know what a job involves 100% until you get into it, you know, and I had seen different things after riding for 3 years, and I just didn't think that was the right path for my brother, but he wanted to do it. So he went to 3 years of college, and then he started riding races, and since then he has graduated college, and he's going for his master's now, and he's got a really good position with a horse fencing company out of Alabama.
Wow.
So he's just got a nice, you know, steady career now, and as you know, a lot less risk, and you know, he's really happy because he gets to be in one place year round, which is a rare thing when you're riding races. And there's a lot of traveling involved, and he gets to be around his son, who's going to be 15. So he really is happy now.
Sure, I understand that. For the first time, I'm in one place for a long time. There is a lot of traveling, and that is tough for a family life. And how about when your brother decided to start riding? And obviously, you were concerned, as you mentioned, for his health and well-being and the tough aspects of that kind of a career. But were you two very competitive with each other?
You know what? We never really had the chance to be. We were growing up. When we were showing horses, because most times we would be in like the same classes or whatnot, but we never really rode together. He rode primarily in Phoenix, Canterbury, in Iowa. So we never, I mean, if we rode for 2 weeks at a time, it would be the most throughout the year when he was just kind of maybe passing through Chicago or something like that. And then He did ride the Chicago circuit, I think, for a couple of years, but then I was gone. At that time, I was in New Orleans or Kentucky or something like that. So we never really had the chance to ride together.
Sure.
But people always did compare us. You know, if anybody knows me or my brother, they would know that we have noticeably different riding styles. And I always thought that was a little unfair for Joel, because he started years later after I did. I think that people kind of tend to compare us too much.
Sure.
But, you know, as far as us being competitive against one another, we never really had that opportunity. But I got to say, when he rode races, Joel is my biggest fan. I mean, he watches every race. If I ride 1,000 races that year, he watches every one of them. But I hated watching them ride. I mean, I would just get nervous and start sweating and get hot, and I never handled watching him ride too well. I would go back and like watch replays after, or like if I knew he won one, but I didn't like watching him ride live.
Really? Really? What about your parents when you were riding and they would watch your races? Were they nervous as well?
You know, I've asked them that a few times, and they both say pretty much no. But that being said, my mom, she will not leave. Well, before like iPod or tablets came out or whatnot, where you could watch stream the races live or whatever, she wouldn't leave the house. I mean, she would not. She would never leave the house until the races were over. Now she will, but only if she has a, she can watch them, you know, whether she's traveling or, you know, at another track or something. She, as long as she has a way to watch me ride, then she'll leave the house. But she's just fanatical about it.
Oh no! Did you now your father, obviously growing up, and I assume you galloped mostly for him, but I'm sure as you got closer to riding, you galloped for everyone. But was he your biggest mentor? Was he your biggest teacher?
Yeah, him, my dad, and my dad's father, and my aunt probably had the biggest influence on me at a young age. My aunt never was involved with racehorses. She does a lot of she did a lot of jumping when she was a kid, and then now she's heavily involved in barrel racing and quarter horses. But she was just I don't know that. I'm a huge believer in too many guys being, or people being just absolute naturals on a horse, and she might be close to that. I've ridden with a few jocks that I felt like were just naturals on a horse, but she was just a tremendous rider, and she had a lot of influence on me at a young age.
Do you feel that helped you, having ridden three-day eventing and barrel racing and other types of riding styles? Do you feel that helped you when you went on to ride races?
100% I do. You know, especially nowadays, I don't know if you could say this for, you know, 20 years ago, and especially 30, 40, 50 years ago, but nowadays it just seems like younger kids kind of come out of the woodwork and don't really know where they come from, and they don't start from the bottom up or have this tremendous background. They just want to start riding right now. And so many young riders are just, whether they realize it or not, they're not ready. And, you know, I look back when I first started riding old tapes or whatever. I mean, oh, my God, I want to turn it off. I just, God, I can't watch this, you know. And I look back and I say I wasn't ready when I started. And I had as much foundation as anyone could ever have.
Right.
I mean, I rode horses every day of my life since I was two, basically.
Right.
But I do think it helped, and I do believe that, like, riding horses is simple as that. It's riding horses, whether it's jumping horse or reining horse or barrel horse or racehorse. It's still riding a horse. So I think I was able to make that transition a little easier. But I'll tell you, I mean, I don't think you ever stop learning. I mean, I think I rode close to 20 years now, and I'm just now becoming somewhat of the rider that I've always wanted to be. I mean, if you stop learning or think you've reached that point, I think you're hurting yourself.
You're absolutely right. And you say now, looking back, you think that you maybe weren't even ready when you first started, but at the time when you did think you were ready, did your father think you were ready? Were you confident that you were absolutely ready to ride?
Yeah, I mean, Dad was, and you know, of course, everybody I talked to said, "Oh, he's, you know, he's as ready as you're going to get in this and that." I just was never, especially at a younger age, I was never satisfied with the way I looked on a horse. I always wanted to be this. And the only thing I could do, I was good out of the gate, and I could switch sticks really good. And you know what? There's a lot to be said for that as like a bug boy or something like that. But I mean, I wanted to be so much better. So far advanced that at an earlier age than what I was, I never was happy with the way I was, you know, 100% happy with the way everything was going. I just wanted to be better all the time. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I just don't think anybody should ever settle in any sport.
Of course, that drive definitely paid off, and you actually won your first career victory at Arlington Park on July 20th, 1995, aboard Apostle Island, who that horse had some family connections.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. My grandpa owned the horse. My dad's father owned the horse. My dad trained the horse, and I rode the horse. I think I was a senior at that time. I didn't even graduate high school at that point. Back in those days, I think, if I remember right, Arlington Park used to have training races for 2-year-olds. And I think I won a training race on her, and then she ended up being my first winner. So that was pretty cool. That's the only thing that really I miss about Chicago. I mean, Chicago's home for me, but the only thing that I really miss about it is riding for my dad.
Sure, that had to be such a special feeling to be in the winner's circle with your father. And did he know that he was putting you on a winner at the time, or was everyone surprised when you crossed that wire in front?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I don't remember. I think if I remember right, she was one of the favorites, but I don't think it was like a huge surprise. But yeah, I mean, you know, Grandpa would always, they lived in northern Wisconsin, about a 6-hour drive, but they would, at that time they were healthy enough, they would drive down for every race that he, you know, every time a horse of his ran, he would come down. But he just, you know, he lived and breathed horses. That was basically his whole life.
It's so great that you had such a wonderful support group behind you. And jockey Jesse Campbell joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Did you start riding full-time immediately after that first win?
No, because I was still in high school at that time. I don't know. I think I had another year left. I can't remember if I was in my junior or senior year at that time. But I started riding races the day after I graduated. I think I was named on like 6 horses at Sportsman's Park. I mean, I was ready to go. As soon as I graduated high school, I was ready to start working.
Jumping at the bit. That's fantastic. Well, what jockeys in the room would you say took you under their wing and helped coach you during those very early years?
At that time, it would have been, you know, guys like Randy Meyer. Early Fires was riding, and they happened to both be in the same corner as me. We had the same valet, so they were a big influence. Randy especially, because I at that time I would ride with him year round. But I had a lot of help. I mean, me and Mark Guidry at that time had the same agent. I mean, Mark was, I don't know, he's won over 5,000 races, so he had a big influence in my career. You know, you had guys like Carlos Silva at that time. Everybody was so nice. You know, to be in such a competitive sport, and where you basically come back into the same locker room as guys you're competing with after every race. I always said that I was fortunate to start in Chicago and in that jocks room, and it was just a really, really good room. And not to mention just a ton of talent. You know, you, if you look up the guys that came out of there at that time, I mean, who came through there? Pat Day, Early Fires, Gary Gomez, Bailey, Mike Smith. I mean, you look at the guys that came through Chicago at that time, just countless races and just a ton of talent. And at that time, we, you know, we had a bull ring at Sportsman's Park, and those guys, you know, they caught you right in the right manner. I don't ever remember having any problems, you know, during races or in the room. Guys were just really, really good. And I don't know if it would have been like that, you know, in other rooms.
Sure.
One of the unique things about Chicago at that time was there were 3 racetracks. It was Sportsman's, Hawthorne, and Arlington, and they were all within, I don't know, probably a 20-mile radius. So guys would be centrally located, and all the riders had families. You know, they all had kids, and they were all settled, and they all had homes that they lived in year-round. So I think it was just a little different kind of setting, you know, to say, because, you know, that's kind of a rare thing in our sport. You know, usually there's a lot of traveling involved.
Well, the good mentors and coaching paid off, Jesse. You were the leading apprentice at Hawthorne Race Course, I believe, yes?
Yeah. I was, and then I think the next year I ended up being leading rider there in the fall.
So quite making a name for yourself from the very beginning. And take us through the next part of your life. Where did you go from there?
I went to Kentucky for a few years, and then I think I rode it. Oh, I rode at Hoosier Park. When they first started, they were running for huge money. So I went there for Stanley Roberts. I was riding all his outfits. And then from there, I rode a few races at Churchill for Al Stahl, and we got lucky and win a few. And I think that was around 99, and he invited me to go to the fairgrounds to ride first call for him. So I would do, from then on, for like the next 16 or so years, I rode fairgrounds in the winter, and then I would come back and basically do Chicago for the rest of the year. I would catch like a few weeks of Hawthorne in the spring, and then Arlington all summer, and then just kind of do that circuit, year-round for the next, I don't know, 15 or 16 years. And I did ride Keeneland in the fall there to fill that gap, I don't know, the last 5 or 6 years or something like that. And then I think in 2000, gosh, I can't even remember. I want to say 2011 or 10, we decided to make the move to Woodbine because it, right around that time, you could just see Chicago, the quality and the purse structure is just declining slowly. And we were forced with the decision to either stay in Louisiana year-round or Kentucky. And then all that traveling that circuit involved, or take a risk and go to Woodbine, and ultimately we chose to go to Woodbine for a couple different reasons.
You say we, Jesse, and you have a wife, Allison. Tell us how you two met, and of course that had to affect your decision as far as the traveling and everything else that involves with that when you have a family. So tell us about Allison.
Well, we met 11 or 12 years ago at Arlington. She was working for a sports marketing company, and then I think she interned at Arlington that summer, and they had some function with some sports marketing younger people, and she happened to be there, and for whatever reason, I happened to be on the apron that morning at Arlington. I think it was a sloppy, at that time it was a dirt track. I think it was a rainy morning or something like that. I had some free time, and I happened to be up on the apron. And I saw her, and then I knew where she worked. I think we briefly talked, and I'm talking for like maybe a half a minute. And we got interrupted, and I didn't know where she worked because of the group that was out there. And like a month later, I don't know, I was just thinking about her for whatever reasons, and I called her work and left a voicemail. On her work phone, or her line, not just again with the receptionist, and she called back, and that was it. We went on our first date, and been together ever since.
The rest is history. That's awesome. That's fantastic. You also have a daughter, Madison.
I do. I have a, well, she's going to be two on February 19th, and you know what? And when I said we a minute ago to make that decision to move to Woodbine, that was, you know, obviously my wife was involved in that decision, and my long-time agent and basically my best friend, Lindy McDaniel, we all sat down and decided to make that move together. And Allison was the one that, and Lindy, they basically said, Jesse, we should take a chance on Woodbine. I wasn't 100% sold on it, but they were the ones that kind of pushed me. And so, yeah, and that was a big risk, you know, taking an outside agent into a new circuit, in a different country. Most people probably would have took a local agent, you know, to get off to a better start. But we have been together for so long, I just didn't think that was fair to do to Lindy. So we all went up there and lock, stock, and barrel, and, you know, really was, you know, nothing but a name. You know, everybody knew who I was, but that being said, you're basically starting from scratch.
I was just going to touch on that. You don't usually see a rider take an agent out of his home track and go somewhere brand new for the both of them. Tell us about your agent.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure you'll attest to it. Racing now has gotten very regional. You know, very rare can a rider and agent travel from state to state, different circuits to different circuits, new group of horsemen and owners, and be successful. So it was a risk, but we had been together for forever, and you know, we work really well together, and Lindy always has my best interest at heart. I mean, he almost protects me to a fault. He treats me like I'm his son, and you know, it's a dangerous game. But you know, if something were to ever really bad happen to me, Lindy, I don't know how Lindy would take it. You know, I just don't know how he would react to something like that. He's just, when it comes to me, sometimes I think I'm kind of all he has sometimes, and he's just a great friend, and he's really good at what he does.
That's fantastic. You don't always see that kind of loyalty and close connections with a jockey and an agent. And so you sat down and decided to go to Canada, and that's not just an easy decision to make. You were going to leave your family and everything else in Chicago.
Yeah, and I you know, I think it was tougher on my wife, Allison. As far as the family aspect goes, she comes from a very big family, a very close family. I have a very close family, but we're a very small family. I think it was tougher on her, especially, you know, she didn't have a job right away when we first got out there, and you know, obviously I had work to go to, but that was tough for her, and that was a pretty big sacrifice for her, especially for the first year. But yeah, it was tough. I mean, the first 3 or 4 months was very tough on me. You know, I was leaving established business too. You know, I'm winning 100 or more races a year. You know, it's like why would you leave that to take a big chance and go to a different country? And it was tough even just to get up there. It's not like you can just say, oh, well, you know what, I want to go to Woodbine and ride. You can't do that. There's a lot of legal paperwork involved, even if you can get the paperwork done. It's very, very difficult. And maybe a lot of people don't know that, but that's why you don't see a lot of guys going up there or getting up there. I know there's quite a few guys that have tried to get up there, and for various reasons, you know, that I wouldn't know, don't get accepted. It's very, very difficult to get your paperwork up there.
We'll talk about that move to Canada when we come back. We'll continue our visit with jockey Jesse Campbell after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Get ready for the 3rd annual Jockeys and Jeans charity event to benefit the PDJF, coming to Gulfstream Park on Sunday, February 28th. Last year, Jockeys and Jeans raised more than $200,000 to benefit permanently disabled riders, and you can help make this year's event even bigger. Meet and mingle with an all-star cast of jockeys, including Lafitte Ping Kai Jr., Georgie Velasquez, Pat Day, Randy Romero, and many more. Tickets go on sale at the beginning of January, and donations and sponsorship can be purchased starting December 7th. For more information, visit jockeysandjeans.com.
Hey, I'm Chantel Sutherland Cruz, and want to tell you all about BetAmerica.com. It's the coolest place to bet on horse racing on over 200 racetracks from America and around the world. New players receive a 100% bonus on your first deposit, up to $300. That's the best sign-up bonus available today. It's time to play the BetAmerica way.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Xacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. First, let's head to New York, where Kendrick Carmouche had a great week, capped off with wins in the Eastview Stakes aboard Absolutely and the Gravesend Stakes aboard Green Grotto. Carmouche finished the week with 4 wins, 1 second, and 3 third-place finishes. John Velasquez won 3 out of 4 stakes mounts at Aqueduct and Gulfstream, including the Grade 3 Sugar Swirl Stakes aboard Best Behavior and the Grade 3 W.L. McKnight Handicap aboard Charming Kitten. Velasquez finished the week with 3 wins for earnings of $213,700. Russell Bays continued dominating North America by winning 50% of his mounts and coming in the money on 71%. For the week, Bays finished with 7 wins, 1 second, and 2 third-place finishes. Finally, our Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Gary Stevens, put on a show for the big crowd at Santa Anita's opening day. Stevens started by winning the Grade 2 Mathis Brothers Mile aboard Om and ended the day by taking the featured Grade 1 Malibu Stakes aboard Run Happy. For the week, Stevens finished with 2 wins and led North America in earnings with $301,000. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, is the perfect read for anyone who has wondered what it takes to be a professional jockey. The sport's most prominent jockeys and trainers tell their stories and share their insights on all that goes on behind the scenes. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit JockeyTalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all of the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And it's crunch time for Midnight Area. 2 stamina-straining furlongs to go in the Queen's Plate for Midnight Area. And Midnight Area is kicked away by 3.5 lengths. And here comes Up With The Birds in full flight. Midnight Area desperately looking for the wire. Up With The Birds on the outside. And it's going to be these two. Midnight Area on the inside. Midnight Area streaks to the wire to win Canada's race. Up With The Birds was second. Dynamic Sky was third. And Spring In The Air was fourth.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Christina McManigal, I am joined tonight by jockey Jesse Campbell. And Jesse, before the break, we were talking about your move to Canada. And as we heard during the replay, that certainly paid off in the long run. And we'll start where we stopped. And you had decided to go to Canada. You had to deal with all of the paperwork and the red tape that you had to go through to move to Canada. And when you first arrived, what were the biggest differences between riding in the United States and riding in Canada?
It was a little odd because everybody on the track, they all knew who I was. All the jocks knew who I was. All the trainers knew who I was. But the owners, most of the owners didn't know who I was. And we found out quickly that a lot of the owners up at Woodbine aren't necessarily from Canada. They're from other countries like Trinidad or Barbados or, you know, you name it. They kind of come from all over. So the toughest thing to do was breaking in with the owners. I mean, we had trainers right and left telling us that they wanted to use us, but their owners didn't, you know, either feed me right enough or, you know, they just weren't getting around to me. It took a good 3 or 4 months and to really start getting some better chances with the bigger outfits, stronger stock. And it was tough. Lindy actually came to me one day I think it was a day off. I was cooking dinner or something. He came upstairs and he said, Jesse, I think I'm going to go home. I said, what are you talking about? He said, Jesse, you should be doing better than this. You know, you should be getting off to a better start. He says, I think it's my fault. I said, I think you'd be better served with a local agent. I said, Lindy, do me a favor. Give it one more month, and if you still feel that way, you know, we'll sit down and we'll discuss that. And I'm telling you, it was literally the next day of races. I mean, all of a sudden, we just started winning races and winning them quick. And then after that, it was, you know, I think we ended up making $4.5 million in purses that year, and that was, you know, that was my worst year at Woodbine. But it was weird how that had happened. You know, he brought that to me, and then all of a sudden, we just started clicking.
Wow, good thing he stuck with it. And on October 19th, actually, in 2012, you won 5 races on a single card at Woodbine. That had to be a pretty incredible feeling.
It was. I won 4 races in a day, probably, I don't know, 50 times. I never won 5, and you know how hard that is. I mean, it's not, even if you think about it, if there's 9 or 10 races and you ride 10 favorites, I mean, the chances of winning 5 are, you know, it's probably not going to happen. You got to have a lot of luck. I mean, everything's got to go your way, you know. Considering the fact that favorites only win about 33% of the time, if you rode 10 favorites, you wouldn't even, mathematically, you shouldn't do it. But, yeah, that was pretty cool. It doesn't happen that often. So that was, I got that picture hanging up upstairs.
Well, and what's funny, you didn't even typically win with those favorites. You would see oftentimes you were lighting up the tote board at Woodbine. And tell us how, when you have a day like that, when you win 5 races, which hardly ever happens, your confidence level just must be out the roof. And how does that affect the way you ride?
Well, I think I've always been better the more I rode. I don't like riding just a few races a day. I like kind of keeping busy where your mind, you know, you don't have time to think, you just react. Everybody's different, whether it's football or basketball or hockey or whatever it may be. I think everybody prepares different and reacts different. But I like being busy. I like riding a lot. But, yeah, when you're winning like that, I mean, it literally, you really, you don't look at odds. Maybe you don't handicap. You just go out there and just ride, and it feels like everything just kind of falls into place. And I don't care what sport it is. I'm a believer in momentum. You know, when things are going good, it just, even outside the racetrack walls, things just seem to be better, taste better, go smoother. I mean, I think I'm a big believer in that.
Well, Jesse, you made a connection with a certain trainer at Woodbine, Nicholas Gonzalez, who we'll talk about some later regarding the Queen's Plate. But how was it that you first connected with Nicholas Gonzalez?
I can tell you exactly how it started. I'm also a big believer, and I'd rather be lucky than good. The Tucci's, our big owner that Nick and Martha have, had his old horse named Artie Hot. I don't know, he was 7 years old or something like that. And one of the riders up there, I won't name who, was riding the horse every race. His form had fallen way off late in the year, and I don't even know if I rode a horse for them before that, maybe just a handful. And they put me on the horse. He was a big long shot. And it was a two-turn race. And I noticed on the horse's comment line, a chart line, it said eight wide, you know, really wide, like every race. So I said, you know what? We got to switch something up here, right? Like, you can't just do the same thing every time and expect a different result. So the horse breaks. He's got no speed. And I just bombed him right to the fence. And, I mean, I'm telling you, at the three-quarter pole, I knew this horse was going to win. Like, I could just feeling underneath him. You know, and them old class horses, they know when they got a chance to, you know.
Sure.
So I never left the rail, and I got through the big full field. I got through everywhere I needed to, and he won easy, and he ended up winning like 4 in a row that year. And the Tucci's, the next spring, they just gave me a chance on a lot of their horses, and Nick and Martha go to Gulfstream every year, and they came back that spring with some fresh, live, fit stock, and we just got off to the good foot again, and ever since then they have been as loyal and as big a supporter as any owner or trainer could be to a rider. I mean, they just, to date, have just been a blessing to us. And they don't tell me how to ride. They very rarely give me instructions. I mean, I can think of a ton of races that I've won for them because they didn't give me instructions or tell me what to do. I know when I ride for them that I can do what I have to do, you know, whether the horse just left or stumbles or, you know, whether the race is not going my way the first part, and they trust me. And I won a stake race for them this year. They told me don't be in the lead, you know, lay like third or whatever, kind of just off the pace. And the horse broke on top, and I let him go to the lead, and he won. And the first thing I said to Martha when I got back, I said, oh, I hope, you know, I had to go to plan B. She said, Jesse, when we leg you up, we know you know what you're doing, and that's why we ride you. And that is rare nowadays, too.
Absolutely.
To have that kind of relationship.
What is it they say? Great jockeys don't need instructions and bad jockeys won't follow them. So perfect example. And it has to be great to win for people like that. And a certain horse, Midnight Aria, kind of really helped you just take off there at Woodbine. And tell us how you got on that horse.
Again, that was a horse that Tucci's had claimed. At Gulfstream, I think they claimed him for like 32.5. And I think they claimed him because he was Ontario bred. You know, and they saw that he could run long and they saw that he might like the grass and this and that. I don't know if they necessarily had Queen's Play dreams, you know, when they claimed him. But they claimed him to go to Woodbine because they had such a good program for Ontario breds. And long story short, he ended up running like close seconds and thirds in all the prep races, and he showed that he could run that far. Just got lucky. You know, it rained a little bit before the race. It tightened the track up. I was in the one hole. We were definitely thinking be in the lead from the word go, and he popped out of the gate running, and I was able to get a nice, pretty easy, comfortable lead going the first turn. And he's not a horse, a typical speed horse, where you would kind of try to back him up and play that cat and mouse game and then try to sprint home. He's just kind of a one-paced horse. He's got a very long stride, and he's a big, heavy horse. I mean, he's just a bull of a horse. And I knew he had, you know, a good 3/8 mile run into him. And I told Nick the morning of the race, I said, Nick, if I happen to be in front, you know, like at the half or the 3/8, I said, I'm going to go. You know, it's going to look like I'm moving too soon, but I can't out-sprint the closest with this horse. You know, I need to kind of try to get some separation and hold on. And once you know it, I mean, just everything fell into place. I mean, even just the bottom maiden claimer, it's hard to get everything go your way exactly in that point of the race that you wanted to or needed to, especially in that kind of race. And it just, everything went my way. And I was able to do exactly that. And he ran the race of his life.
We heard the replay of that 2013 Queen's Plate during the break, and I have to say that was an incredible race to watch. And holding on by just half a length, as you said, you had to make that separation there. And what emotions were you feeling as you crossed the wire in front?
It took me a couple of jumps after the wire, and then I just exploded with emotion. I mean, like I said before, everybody prepares different, and everybody has their way to get themselves ready. And when it comes to big races, I don't, whether I'm 2-1 or 30-1, it's just, I don't think about it. Because to me, until you win it, it doesn't really mean anything. It's just another horse race, you know. And it took me some years to get to that mindset. I'll tell you a funny story. The first big race I ever won, I won the Super Derby for Al Stahl. It was a short field. And Al had given me certain instructions, and I rode to those instructions. And I'm telling you, I could have rode 100 races and not gotten a horse in more trouble than this horse got. In fact, I remember the half-mile pole just kind of looking over and just shaking my head and thinking, you know what, this really sucks, but I'm just going to have to eat this horse. And I happened to find a little room, and he got up and won. And I said from that day on, I said, you know what, I will never be nervous during another race in my entire career, and I ride for myself from now on. And that, I've had that mindset since that day. And that was a long time ago. But, you know, I think it takes riders or any athlete to be in those certain situations a handful of times before you can, you know, make that move to where you block out all the BS and just do your job to where it's just like any other race.
Did you notice that your business really take off after that victory?
Yeah, it did. It was kind of on that way to really kind of making the next level of business or the clients that I had up there, but that really helped. And not only that, on the same day, I won a grade two for Reed Baker about four races before that. So, you know, when you have days like that, it really helps you. I don't know. I guess some people, maybe not all, look at you just a little different, kind of like you sitting there done that type of thing. And it really helps with the owners. So, yeah, I mean, you could definitely see my business change a little bit after that.
Definitely a great day for you. And as I mentioned during the intro, I'm here in our Lexington, Kentucky studio. Of course, we had the Breeders' Cup here this year. Jesse, you were a part of that.
Yeah, I got to ride a two-year-old called Riker for the Tootsies, for Nick and Martha. So that was special. And since they've been just such good supporters of me and my wife and Lindy, that was really neat to ride that race for them. And they had a lot of fun, and the Tootsies had a lot of fun. So that was pretty cool.
And that horse, Riker, was undefeated going into the Breeders' Cup. Is there talk of him still on the Derby trail?
You know, I don't know what their exact plans are for him. I know he went immediately to Florida for rest. I know he's sound, and I know he's healthy. I don't know what their plans are with him because he's not Ontario bred. He's Kentucky bred. So I don't know what their plans are for. I actually talked to Nick a couple weeks ago, and he said he was still in Florida on R&R. So I'm sure I'll talk with Nick or Martha soon and see what their plans are with him.
And this year was actually your second ride in the Breeders' Cup. Tell us about your first.
Well, that was really special because I got to ride the horse for my dad. My dad had claimed the horse first time out at Arlington. And then he ended up winning like four or five in a row. He won a couple stakes, two turn stakes in Iowa. And I hadn't been riding him because I was in, you know, obviously a Woodbine every day. And to take off a full cart of races to go, you know, ride one horse. I think the stakes at Iowa, like $100,000, it just didn't make sense. But, you know, and of course it's a little easier to make that decision because I know he's my dad's horse. You know, if he ever makes that next level, it's not that hard to, you know, to kind of get in that spot. But that was really cool. And the owners that had owned that horse have been, I mean, they've been with my dad since, I don't know, I think since I was like 14 years old. And, you know, we showed horses with their daughter, and I mean, They live within a stone's throw of me in Chicago. They're just really good friends, and they've been longtime supporters of my dad. So that was really neat to do that.
That had to be such a special experience. And I looked at the Jockeys Guild website actually, and at that time it was written, you said that your greatest achievement was winning two graded stakes for your dad, and that has to be such a special feeling to get to that point with your dad, not only your first race of your career, but to go on and win graded stakes for your dad.
Yeah, they both were horses that he claimed out of Oaklawn. I think he claimed them both for like $32,000 or $35,000. That was just one of those years where dad had a great year. I think he had about 30 head at that time, and just they were all winning. I mean, it wasn't just those two. We just had a killer year. And the one day, I think, yeah, we win the Carey Memorial at Hawthorne with no talents. And then on that same day in the Hawthorne Gold Cup, I think at that time it was $500,000, the other horse that I had won a graded stake with him earlier in the year, he ran third on that day. So that was a fun day to go through that with my family. It's like my dad and mom came, and my brother, everybody came back to my house. The owners came back. I mean, we probably had 20 or 30 people at my house after the races, and we just, you know, ordered food, and everybody was having a few drinks, and that was a pretty cool day.
Jockey Jesse Campbell joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jesse, also during the intro, I mentioned that you just had your 2000th win, actually on May 18th at Woodbine with Sweet Grass Creek. What a day that had to be.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. What really made it special is my mom and my brother, girlfriend had drove up from Chicago. They surprised me. I didn't know they were coming. And so that was fun to have them there. You know, it was nice as a milestone, and it takes a lot of, it's not something that everybody gets to. And I know there's riders that have won certainly a lot more races than I have and that, but it's a neat milestone. But to be honest, I think my family probably enjoyed it more than I did. I mean, I was happy. Don't get me wrong, and I think because my mom was there, I think I did cry a little bit. But I think I enjoyed it more because they were there, and I could see how much they enjoyed it. So I think that probably meant more to me than anything else.
Well, they had to be very, very proud, and you had to look back and see what a long journey and hard work and effort you had to put in, and all the bright moments, of course, as well, but. You've had frequent injuries during your riding career, and talk about that, especially now that you're a father. How difficult is that to go through?
Well, since you bring it up, I mean, everybody has different mindsets, but that's one of the reasons why I waited so long to have a child. In fact, I always said I always wanted a little girl, but I didn't want to try for kids until I was done riding, because I didn't want that scenario in my life. I've seen a lot of good friends of mine really get hurt severely, you know, with young families, and it just, you know, broke my heart to see, you know, the way what their kids had to go through. And I never wanted that to happen. In fact, when I went down in November, I mean, when I regained consciousness, the first thing I said, told someone, is call my wife and tell her, don't bring my daughter. You know, I didn't want her to see me like that. So it's tough, you know, and I purposely waited that long. If it wasn't for Canada, I firmly believe I wouldn't have her, simply for the fact that we're able to stay in one place year-round and ride in one track and be in one house for the whole year. There's no traveling, there's no, you know. So I think Canada is also a blessing in my mind for that. But, yeah, it's tough. I mean, I do think that I am handling it better than I thought I would. I don't think about it near as much as I thought I would. But, you know, my wife and my daughter very rarely come out to the races. I think if they come two or three times, that's about it for the year. I just do better when they're not there. I just want to focus on what I have to do and you know, see them after the races. But, you know, I'm handling it better than I thought I would.
Something else I also read, Jesse, was that you don't even watch the races when you're hurt, because watching makes you upset, and I can relate to that. I remember recovering from injuries and literally throwing things at the TV when I would see horses I'd ridden win without me. And so yeah. People, I don't think, really understand what kind of a feeling that is to watch all of your hard work that you were putting in and you can't be a part of it because you're hurt. Talk about that.
Well, and you're right. That's literally the way it is. That's your hard work. That's, you know, you getting up at 5:30 every morning. That's, you know, all the horses you worked in the morning, all the relationships. That's your hard work out there, and someone else is getting paid for it. And I got to tell you, I don't. If somebody took that easy, I'd have to question their mindset. You know, I mean, that's food off my table. That's the way I look at it. I've watched three horse races since November 5th, and they are all three horses that my brother rode for my dad. I used to be really bad. I mean, when I was younger, if I got beat in the nose or something, I literally wouldn't sleep at night. And I've gotten better about that now. But no, I want nothing to do with watching horse races when I'm out, because it's going to do two things: either get me in a bad mood or make me want to start back a lot sooner than I should. So
right.
I'm better served just not watching races when I'm off.
Right. Nothing good can come out of that. And, Jesse, I can also relate somewhat to You have somewhat of a difficult time with your weight. Not a lot, but you run a lot. Is that right?
Yeah, I used to run a lot. You know, with the rubber suits on and all that. I've had to back off on that here. Last year was the first year I didn't run a lot because my knees have just gotten so bad. I had them worked on a few times, and last year I tore my I'm forgetting what they even call it, meniscus, and then this year I tore my MCL earlier, like in the summer, so I was dealing with that the rest of the year. I'm just not able to run like I used to, so I've really had to back off on that. But yeah, I mean, you know, without getting too deep into it, I wouldn't say I fight as much as most, you know, just about any other rider, unless you're 4 foot nothing, and it's a little easier on you, but it's it's, people don't realize the discipline that it takes to do what we do, or probably just about any other athlete. But you know, and again, back to missing out on horses winning when you're not. If people don't, you know, they might think about, but if we had contracts, you'd certainly have a different mindset. You know, if we're not riding, we're not making money, and especially if we're not winning, we're not making a whole lot of money. So that whole thing of, you know, oh, gosh, did that guy really try that time? I mean, you know what? If I don't run first, second, or third, it's I'm not making any money. You know, I'm not going out there just to put gas in my car, you know.
Right.
So it's tough. I kind of relate to a little bit like a doctor. You're almost on call 24/7. Because even right now when I'm not riding, I know come March 1st, I have to be 114 pounds. And I'm not going to just be lazy and you know, blow up to 140 pounds because that's not fun losing it. And it's hard on your body. And so it's tough. You know, you got to live and breathe it. And you got to be hungry for it. And if you don't live like that, you just, there's no way, I don't think that you're going to be able to perform at the best level.
That's exactly right, Jesse. And we just have a couple more minutes here. This hour's flown by. What would you say? What career goals are you still working towards?
You know what? I want to make the top 100 all-time money one. And I think right now I'm like 101st or 102nd on that list. And I would have made it if I wouldn't have, I missed about 6 or 7 weeks of the meet this year. I would have made it easy, but that's kind of next on my list. I want to be able to print that out on Equibase and put it in a little frame and look at it 20 years from now, you know, and say that I had done that. And honestly, the only goal after that I have is I just want to make it. I want to end my career with everything works, you know. I want to be healthy enough to enjoy the second part of my life, you know.
Very, very good goal to have, Jesse. Tell us, what do you do for fun on your days off? Not that, as you said, it's really a living and breathing type of career, but when you get a chance, what do you do for fun?
I love to fish, especially being up in Canada. There's water so close to us and so many lakes. It's just, we love to just, whether it's fishing or just take the boat out and go for a couple hour boat ride, we love to be in the water, both my wife and I. Madison, she loves it too. She doesn't like to get in the water, but she likes to be on the boat. I mean, she'll go out there fishing with me for 3 or 4 hours, no problem. She's got, God bless her, she's got the patience at a young age to do that. She doesn't get it from me, but I just kind of feel like it's, you get out there and you just forget about things, whether it's for a half a day or so. We really enjoy to do that.
All right, Jesse, we're all out of time. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
If you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can listen on our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.